This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Who are the Yippies? Or even the Beatniks and Hippies? What was student protest like in Vancouver during the 60s and 70s? How has anarchism and the counterculture influenced Vancouver today? Larry Gamboni has been an activist since his youth. He's just written a memoir, No Regrets, Counterculture and Anarchism in Vancouver, all about his experiences in the anarchist movement, and he joins me on the phone from his home in Nanaimo. Hello, Larry.
Hello, Lorraine. Thank you for inviting me on.
Our total pleasure. What is, and I'm saying in quotes here, the counterculture and how was it formed?
Well, there have been countercultures for many years, actually probably dating back to the early 19th century, like the Bohemians. A counterculture evolves when people decide that they want to live a different lifestyle than the existing lifestyle that they've been given. And, for example, with the Bohemians, you have a bunch of artists and writers and activists coming together in the big cities like New York and Paris and that sort of thing, and trying to live a different way and a creative way.
Were there different kind of strands of movements or groups that came together to form a broader counterculture?
Yes. The 1960s, 70s counterculture was not unique. Its history, there are various strands of its history go way back. And so what you have is a coming together in the 1960s of different groups like anarchists, pacifists, organic gardeners, artists and writers of all description, and craftspeople and activists of all different kinds, and musicians and folk musicians, and all these kind of people that existed in tiny groups, separate, all of a sudden come together in the 60s and form this one group. And of course, it takes time for them to all pull together. It doesn't happen all at once.
It seems to me like an element of that particular counterculture was a kind of an opposition to sort of like staid conventional, like it followed on, you know, 1950s American dream culture, and it seemed counterposed to that. Am I accurate in thinking that?
Absolutely. I mean, intelligent young people are opposed to the consumerism, the conformity, and of course the authoritarianism, which was rank in the schools, and the propaganda, the insane level of anti-communism, the racism, and later, as it came out, the sexism as well that was so prevalent then. All these things fueled the fire, right?
And how did the Vietnam War figure into this counterculture in North America?
I would say that it was like pouring gasoline onto a fire. When I first got involved in the counterculture in 1965, the end of the Beat generation, we were just a small group, you know, a few hundred people. But later, when the hippie thing happened, there was a growth of the movement, and then with the Vietnam, there was a war, there was a radicalization of the movement, as all these young people were being repressed in the United States and forced into the army. So this had a radicalizing effect, and these young Americans coming up from the South too, right?
Now, I think a lot of people are familiar with the hippies. Who are the Yippies?
The Yippies, well, they originated from a group of American radicals like Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman in the States, who came up with some media ideas for creating revolutionary scandals and this sort of thing. But we in Vancouver, we picked up on this idea. What we were is we were some ex-students from Simon Fraser, young counterculturals from the East End in Kitsilano, and we took the name Yippie and became a radical activist group based around that name.
Well, that's when counterculturals could afford to live in Kitsilano.
Yes. It was incredibly cheap to live in those days. I think that was one of the bases of the counterculture, is that a bunch of you could rent an old house for $100 a month, and you could live on almost nothing. not today.
Now, I understand you also had a newspaper at the time.
Well, of course, it was the Georgia Strait, but the Yippies, we had their own newspaper, the Yellow Journal, which ran to about 13 issues. It was also in conjunction, it wasn't just ours alone, it was in conjunction with another group called the Vancouver Liberation Front. The two groups, Yippies and VLF, worked together on that paper and worked together in actions as well.
Now, what sort of activism did you and the Yippies do in Vancouver?
A lot of it had to do with the repression of youth, because at this time, young people from all across Canada were pouring into Vancouver, and the police were arresting them for pot, and they were being arrested for vagrancy and harassed, and there was a general campaign in the Vancouver Sun against the so-called hippies, so we organized around discrimination.
I understand that you tried to levitate the police station. Jim just explained that to me, but can you tell me more about that?
This was an action to against the arrest of all the young people who were being busted for pot at this time. So we surrounded the police station and chanted and tried to levitate it.
How'd it go?
Well, it didn't move very much, but we managed to get involved with the Vietnam demonstration and liven that up along the way. So there was about 100 of us, so we got involved in the demonstration and we're chanting and running around and just generally enlivening an otherwise boring demonstration.
I understand that one of the targets of your actions was also that famous oppressive organization, the Bay.
Yes. Well, the Bay had been discriminating against hippies. They refused to serve any long hair in the cafeteria. So we organized a sit-in in the cafeteria. And there's about 200 of us. So we went in there and sat in, and then the police arrived. And we decided we'd leave rather than confront the police, so we ran out in the street. And then people spontaneously decided to go to the American consulate. So we ran down the whole length of Georgia Street and ended up at the American consulate, and the consulate ended up getting trashed.
Tell me about the invasion of Blaine, Washington.
This was when Nixon invaded Cambodia. So along with the VLF, decided we would have a symbolic invasion of the United States as a way of protesting Nixon's invasion of Cambodia. So about 600 of us gathered at the American border in Blaine, and nobody actually thought we were actually going to invade the United States, but there were only two guards, so all of a sudden everybody rushed across the border and they ran into Blaine. And they got into some fights with some Americans, and a few windows got broken, and some flags got taken, and everybody then rushed back across the border. And as I say, it was the quickest victory Canadians ever had.
Now, I'm going to leap ahead into the early 80s, probably a little closer in the memories of some people who live in Vancouver. What was the almost general strike?
Well, the BC government had decided that they were going to do a lot of cutbacks, and they were going to attack the BC government employees union. And this was the beginning of the sort of neoliberalism that we've been living with since. And so there was a coming together of the trade unions and the social movements. And there were some huge demonstrations occurred, 80,000 people, for example, in front of the Vancouver Hotel when the Social Credit was having its convention. And it got to the point where there was almost a general strike. The shoe was about to drop, and then the BC Federation of Labor sent Jack Munro in to in Kelowna to make a deal with the Socreds, and that was sort of the end of it. The BCGEU basically was protected, but all the cutbacks happened, and everybody felt really sold out. So that was that's why it was an almost general strike.
And how did you participate in that strike?
Well, I had to participate as an individual. There was no organized sort of effort on the part of the far left. People on the far left sort of trailed the labor unions, which is unfortunate. So I just handed out a comic that I made about the need for a general strike, and I was involved in trying to get people to sit down in front of the Vancouver Hotel as a way of protesting the Socreds, but parade marshals quickly put a stop to that.
Now, at the end of your book, you list 50 things the counterculture did for you. Tell us a bit about the legacy of the counterculture from your perspective.
Well, it's an enormous legacy. It's so ubiquitous that a lot of people don't even know about it. You know, when these changes happen, it just becomes natural. Like, for example, something as silly as avocados. I don't remember anybody eating avocados when I was a kid, but it was all the California hippies that came up here brought avocados, so we started eating them. Backpacks, you know, something as silly as that. Only hikers use backpacks. Now everybody uses them. But other stuff like Greenpeace, that came out of the counterculture. The Green Party, that came out of the counterculture. The whole movement for the new co-ops and the new worker co-ops that developed in the 70s, that came out of the counterculture. Fair trade products, the whole environmental movement, that came out of the new feminism, all of this. I mean, it's all part of today, right? And it all comes from this time period.
Well, it's been interesting talking with you today, Larry Gamboni, and I appreciate the book.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on.
I've been speaking with Larry Gamboni. He's just written a memoir called No Regrets, Counterculture and Anarchism in Vancouver, which is available from Black Cat Press.